It's an artist I like a lot, Saint Evo. Song is called Shy. We are now wrapping up the house, the Afro house, the soulful house, the Amar Piano set. We play that fresh, that smooth, that dope music from the continent. And from around the world, anything that's fresh, please send it to me, tembosounds@gmail.com. Hit me up on all the socials at Tembo Sounds. You can get a hold of me that way. And you can leave me a voicemail at 412-499-5000. Let me repeat that number one more time for those that are a bit slow today because you've been catching up on some adult beverages and whatever it is that you do when you're relaxing and unwinding over the weekend. That's 412-499-5000, yeah?
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert, and joining us from South Africa is the newest member of our show, Kusi Veto. Kusi, how are you today?
Awesome, I'm fine. Thank you very much for having an opportunity. This is my second time being on the show. The last time it was an amazing experience for me, learning new things, and also looking forward into this one, getting more knowledge.
Yes, Kusi was so, you seem to be having, which made me so happy, you seem to be having such a fun time last week talking to our guest. You seem to really enjoy it.
And especially with the initiative that she's doing, and also to a point where it seems like, you know, in certain things that you'll find that South Africans or we experience, you would think that in other countries in the world, they not. But it shows you that we as a human family, we have so much in common, especially when it comes to our struggles.
And that's the beauty of this show, because you and I can both have different takeaways from the stories we hear, but we're all still human beings and have the same human experience. That's the beauty of it,
definitely,
I feel.
Definitely, definitely. Even this one, I'm looking forward to this one to learn more. It will seem like I'm not involved, but I am, because I'm observing at the same time, getting more into my mind and knowledge.
Absolutely. And this week we're going to be talking about the magic of the movies, and we are joined by Miss Debbie Markowitz to tell us a little bit more about that. Debbie, thank you so much for coming on this show.
And thank you for having me. I love talking about this stuff, and it's great to meet people from around the world also. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it really is. So when did your love of this industry of film and movies and what it could do, when did that first start for you?
Oh my God, I was really young. I wrote my first book as far as the medium, when I was like 6 years old. And I loved old movies. So I'd say I had a little black and white TV in my room. And even in elementary school, I would stay up to watch the late movie and the late movie and the late movie before everything was 24 hours. And I just loved the old Jeanette McDonald, Nelson Eddy, all that other stuff. I would just watch that stuff all night long. I don't know how I ever functioned otherwise. And then when my parents would bring their friends over, if they had kids, I would kind of like to, I would make up little plays in my mind and direct them. And I didn't know that was directing. I was just playing. I didn't know it was a thing or that it was anything I could do. So it's something I always had in my mind. I started out as a drama major. I was in plays in junior high school and high school, though in very, very minor roles. And then I just got busy with life. And although I started it in Nassau Community College as a theater major, only did it for the first session or second, because I realized I needed to get a job. So I switched over to business management. And then when I moved to Hofstra, that's what my degree was in. But I just always loved movies. It took me 8.5 years to get through Hofstra, only because I worked two jobs. I worked full-time and part-time, so I only took part-time classes at night. Somewhere in there, towards the end, I got a job working for the county executive office and writing scripts and writing press releases. And I just didn't find it really fulfilling, so I started looking around the county, and I found a department called Commerce and Industry. And I said, all right, well, I have a business degree. And I started looking through files, and I realized that they would do a couple of film permits a year. And so I want to know more about that. So I started asking questions, found out that there was a New York City Film Commission, a New York State Film Commission, even a Suffolk Commission, but NASA didn't have one. So I basically put together a proposal, went to the county executive at the time and said, you know, I can get you a lot of PR. And also we can make a lot of money if you let me do something with this. And he thought about it, and he basically said, you got 6 months, don't embarrass me. And we ended up probably up until, well, I left 5 years ago, but we were at the time the most successful film commission in all of the major metropolitan area. So it's always been in one way or another. I've loved this industry. I've loved helping people make movies before I started making my own. But that's a long-winded answer to how I got interested.
Deborah, I see that you, I know that with the love for you for movies and also for storytelling, but now I saw that you also served for the foundation. You know, you were the vice president of a Long Island Film, TV and Foundation, you know, helping people to tell their story. That's community work, you know, that's giving back to the community.
Yes.
In terms of giving opportunities to those who feel like it's taking them long to tell their stories. Can you tell me about that journey? You know, what sure. sparked you to give back to the community, whatever community the foundation was serving?
Sure. Well, now I was the vice president of the Long Island Film and TV Foundation, and now I've been the president for the last few years. It started out as part of the Film Commission job because we were approached by the Long Island Film and TV Foundation, and they had a film festival in Suffolk, but didn't have one in Nassau. And at the time, you know, I spoke to our film commission and they sort of felt it was a win-win. They'd get up some movies, it would be really easy. And at this point now, I'd had a Persa County executive because you have to approve everything in government. He said, you know, okay, let's do it. And then probably 4 to 6 weeks before, part of that relationship fell apart where we didn't end up getting any films. And now I've already promised the county that we were going to have a film festival. And it's not like today. I think there was one other film festival on Long Island and maybe a couple in the city, but there was not like there's one on every corner now. So I had to put together a film festival. And I worked with the owners of the Malvern Cinema 4, Ann and Henry Stamfell. And so we got a theater for that. And then I reached out to all the post houses that I had worked with through the film commission. We ended up getting films in 35 millimeter and 16 millimeter and some on VHS because that was a video component back then. And we had to pull it off in a ridiculous amount of time, but we did. Because it went well, it sort of became part of what I did, but not really part of what I did for the county. And then at this point, it became a separate thing in itself. Now the county, we're in the county, but they don't really participate. I've left the film office to pursue a full-time filmmaking career myself, writing and directing. It is giving back, and we always give back. That's something my husband, who's my business partner, that we also do besides the film festival, which is just such a tremendous amount of work. We just finished our 28th year. But we also do it by training some people we know have a lot of promise in the film industry. For example, our very first feature film, we'd already made many shorts. We knew that we didn't really have the budget we needed. So we tried to figure out how we could pull a film off with almost no money. And so we decided was to train a crew. We would give them a small stipend, but we would train them on sound. We would train them as gaffers. We would train them in almost everything except hair and makeup because we don't have that proficiency. And now, and as ADs and second ADs, and now several of those people are working full-time in the film industry at those positions. So another thing we did was after making a couple of feature films, John Marine, who is my husband and business partner, is a phenomenal teacher. He's a 20 LaGuardia Arts, which is the FAME school. He was their technical director. He's been a teacher for decades. And so we would just handpick a selection of filmmakers we know showed promise, and they would come over to the house and he would teach them, what do you want to learn this time? So we had a series of classes around my kitchen island on assistant director classes. We did scripty classes. We did basic red editing, you know, whatever they're interested in. If we can get four or five people that we know show promise and you know, really take the craft seriously, we train them for their next step. So it's kind of a twofold thing. They're going to help us when we don't have a lot of money for a project, but we're going to refer them when we get hired and do. And so it works out really nicely. And they're all taking off. They're all working like crazy in the industry. So it's you kind of have to give back. It's just a natural thing to us, you know, but then you have to get to the point where that almost has to be limited in a way because you get so busy with your own career. You know, but you still always try to give back when you do. That's just, I think, always been instilled in me for whatever reason, and my husband as well.
We're going to bounce around a little bit because you just gave us a lot of material there, Debbie, so we can go back and forth throughout the interview on different sure. topics. But sure. I want to ask you about the Long Island International Film Expo and Festival that you just did. It's 28 mm-hmm. years. This could be a long-winded question, and I apologize for it.
That's okay.
But how do you put it together originally, like you said, starting out? How do you put it together originally, grow it every year? And then tell us about how this year went.
Okay, well, Just to bring up an anecdote too, is several years ago when the economy crashed, I want to say, I think it was 2008, I was interviewed by the New York Times, and the reporter had said to me, how are you getting bigger when all these other film festivals are closing? And my answer was, well, none of us get paid for that, so we can't get paid less. So as long as we have a venue willing to work with us and people willing to help, we don't lose anything. You know, we just continue going on. But when we started, again, we had to pull it together quickly. The technology has changed so much over the years. So every time that happens, there's a bump in what we have to learn in the learning curve. Different equipment, different people to run things if necessary. We added panels where we never had panels in the beginning. And that changes every year. We have some standards, but if we've done, say, legal and liabilities for many years, then we switched this year to the assistant director panel. Since we had had so much success with the people we taught, we figured we'd open it up to a wider audience. So we have better festing panels for the last few years. And what we do is we bring in festival directors from different film festivals that may be very hard to get into, but people can come and meet them and find out what they're looking for. You know, brings us together. Like this year we had the Soho International Film Festival. We had Sybil Santiago from that. We had Jarrett Martino from Love Wins, which is out in Suffolk, is an LGBTQ film festival. We had Doug LeClaire from the Asbury Shorts Film Concert. We also had Kathy Cato from the Queens World Film Festival. And in the past, we brought people in from, we didn't bring them in, they came in themselves, but we also had Cedric Thomas Smith from the Austin Revolution Film Festival. And, you know, and the people from Phoenixville in Pennsylvania came in. Kyle came in and Sam Avery from Blackbird came in. And, you know, it's a way to bring people together, which is really what the film festival is mostly about. But it's a tremendous amount of work. And so we're always kind of looking for new people to bring in to help. But it's difficult because our motto has always been, it's about the filmmakers. And so you have to show that balance of the best films you can with people who want to participate, who bring something to the community, you know, and it's a difficult thing. And sometimes you bring people in, but they're trying to get in front of the camera instead of pushing the filmmakers in front of the camera. And it's you don't want it to become a vanity project for somebody, because you always have to remember the core, which is getting films out there, getting good films out there. But more than ever, it's been about the community and bringing people in from all over the world. And your worldview changes because of that. Things that are natural to me, because I've spoken to and started relationships with these people from all over the world, not everybody gets that, you know. But if you come to the film festival and the filmmaker comes in and you get to see their films, but you also get to maybe meet them after their Q&As and hang out in the lounge and talk to them, I mean, it changes the world. So to me, that's the most important thing, you know, is to bring people together, to open people's eyes to the worldview. But as far as what we do, the technology changes. And honestly, it's very difficult. I think every year we go, oh, we're not doing this again. And then you have a successful film festival, like this year was amazing. And then you're like, all right, we can do it another year, maybe another 2 years. But it is giving up. I mean, this year I only gave up 2 months of my life. It used to be I would give up 6-8 months of my life, work till 3 in the morning. And I'm just not willing to do that anymore because of my own filmmaking career. You know, but this year was great. We didn't have a ton of foreign filmmakers this year for reasons probably everybody knows about, but had a couple of filmmakers come in from London, two separate films. We had several from Canada come in. People flew in from California. People drove in from Pennsylvania, Florida. And of course, our very all the local filmmakers that we have. But it's all about the connections. And that's when you know it's successful. If somebody wins or not, but the fact that they met somebody that maybe will produce their film in the future, and that has happened. Steven Sipelis, who had a film this year, who's had several films in over the years, met his producer, Ken Frank, several years ago, and they've produced two films since. Janet Villarosa, who was originally from the Philippines, came in several years ago, and she met the Salazar brothers, Juan Pedro and David Salazar, and she ended up producing a film for them. And stuff like that's gold. It's magic. So it is really hard because there's a lot of technical work. There's a ton of administrative work, putting together spreadsheets, making sure everything's on the website. That stuff is tremendous. And we showed 132 films. So every one of those filmmakers got a lot of attention, you know, from us sending out what all the activities are, making sure the website was up to date, making sure all corrections happened, making sure everybody knew where they had to go, when they had to be there. And I think we had about 400 entries. Each of those gets a lot of care because it seemed like, I think we have 6 or 7 judges this past year. So they have all their scores in, and you're going to have somebody who likes a film and somebody who hates a film, and a lot of people in between. So it's then discussing what has to happen with that film. What do we take? What's best for the film festival? What fits in the film festival? And then once the judges come up with the scoring system, we go back again and say to all the judges, what are your three to five favorite films that maybe didn't even score well, but you want to see them in the film festival? Maybe the post production wasn't as clear as it could have been, but the story is brilliant. Maybe it's a young up-and-coming filmmaker. For example, we had a documentary many years ago. And I'm not going to remember the name, but he was a filmmaker. I think he was 11 or 12 years old, and he had a severe form of muscular dystrophy, but he made a computer-generated short film about why people shouldn't feel bad for people who have disabilities, because they have many other abilities. And we had to show that, you know, it was brilliant. So it's trying to make sure that the judges feel valued for putting in the tremendous amount of time that they do, making sure that the filmmakers feel valued. And it's very hard to not take a film that's maybe very good, but there's only so many films you can take. And so we have a wait list. If we have to remove a film for whatever reason, like this year, somebody just stopped responding. We couldn't get the film from them. So after giving them 2 or 3 shout outs, we had to remove the film and replace it. We made somebody else very happy. So it's just so much care putting that all together and trying to do it for the right reasons. As an aside, my film company is called Intention Films and Media, because I think you have to do things with the right intention if you want them to come out well and not make things just vanity projects. So you try to give everybody care, and you know you're always going to fall short somewhere, which is heartbreaking when you do, but you always do the best you can. And we always tell people, I send an email after and say, what is there anything you felt we could have done better? Keep in mind, this is two main people doing most of this work until we get to the film festival itself. Not getting paid. So you can throw money at things and make a lot of things a lot better. But, you know, you have to be realistic with the resources that we have. And we do a bang up job for really an unpaid crew. It's just crazy, you know, but it's this year was phenomenal. So many incredible documentaries, as well as the features and people that really had a great time hanging out together and getting to know each other. It was great energy all the way through. And then when you have a year like that, yeah, it makes it all worth it until the next year and you go, oh my God, I got to do this again. I hope that my long-winded answer again.
Again, if you have just tuned in now, you're tuning in to Bush Radio 89.5 FM with One World Radio. Actually, this is One World Radio, or One World Community Radio Network. It's the first ever open source community radio network designed to connect broadcast stations around the world. Collaborators are invited also to submit content to this so that you can be a part of this. And also, we are speaking to Deborah Markowitz, who is also a filmmaker, speaking to us about her journey. I know that, you know, Debbie, is that you, I don't know how where to put you. You know, you've acted as a casting director, consultant, producer, you know, on TV and commercial projects. You know, you've done a lot. So I want to know, how would you say you are? Are you a filmmaker or you're a creator? You're a creative? Because nowadays, titles, you know, people will title themselves, especially with the art that they align themselves with.
Oh, that's a really, really good question. I mean, if you had to put the umbrella title, it would be creator, because to me, it's all about creating, whether I'm writing a novel or making a movie or helping somebody else make their movie. You know, it's so it's really is all about creating to me. When I write a script and make the movie, it's creating worlds. That's what we do. You know, you see it. And then, at least in my case, I can't stop thinking about it until it's done. You know, it literally, the characters will wake me up at night because I think of a conversation they should have had or will have. For example, there's a short film I did called Waitlist, A Lovish Story. We basically made that to try out a new camera we bought. We bought a new Red camera. And before we let people hire us, we want to make sure everything works. We know exactly what we're doing. And so we did this short film. And after filming, it was one day I realized, I want to know what happens to these characters. This is a feature. And I've never done this before, but right after we filmed, I think it was a Friday, for 5 days, I almost didn't leave my desk. And 5 days later, I said to my husband, I said, oh my God, I just wrote a feature film. And I actually think it's okay. I think it's pretty good. And he said to me, and at this point, I thought weeks had gone by. And he said, you realize it was 5 days. I'm like, I wrote a feature film in 5 days? And I was just driven by it. And then we went almost immediately into production, but it was creating the whole world of these two characters who never should have gotten together and all the obstacles that they faced. And it went from a small project to a big project. And then I realized, because I love the script so much, I said, you know what? I don't think I'm doing this film justice if I don't bring any names in it. So I contacted some celebrity friends from Blue Bloods and Blair Witch 2 and also from The Grudge. And I just said, hey, I have these parts. You know, what do you think? And then all of a sudden I had names involved. So that changed everything. So you're creating, I think creator is probably the biggest thing that I do. But if I had to just do one thing, I'm going to say writing with directing as second. But I do think that it all falls under creator.
Going back to the film festival for a moment, the International Film Festival, what spoke to me about that was you were saying you have filmmakers from all over the world come in and mm-hmm. tell their different stories, and you see different kinds of life represented. As Kusi and I were talking about in the beginning, what's great about the show is even though we're on two totally different sides of the world, we capture the human experience. How would you say you view the human experience differently after seeing all these films from all over the world?
I think that, I mean, I've always been pretty open-minded. You know, my parents did some really cool stuff when I was younger that really meant a lot to me as I got older. You know, we're all flawed humans, obviously. But for example, one thing they did was I grew up in Merrick on Long Island, which was traditionally just a very white community. That was it. There was nobody else here at that point. And so they made sure I went to a camp, the YMCA, so that I would get to meet different people. So to me, it was just always normal. It didn't, you know, nothing fazed me. But every time you work with people from somewhere else that has a story that maybe you didn't know of previously, you know, it kind of normalizes it. And, all right, there's other people that are different than me. That's really cool. When I was younger, you didn't hear about LGBTQ people. I mean, the only thing that I heard of was my mother was a waitress at one point and worked next to a hair salon. And she would tell me about the boys next door and there's men who like men. I didn't really classify it. It didn't mean anything other than there's people who do whatever they do. Then running the film festival, you see it more in depth. Because you have LGBTQ films, because you have films with relationships of people from all over the world and different languages and different countries, everything becomes just more of what the world should be full of, you know, which is the diversity. So every year we do it, we're learning something new. There's a documentary teaching us something new. It's about learning and growing, and you hope that you can bring that to the audience. But there's things that, I mean, I don't want to get political, and so I won't, but there's people who complain about things that they're uncomfortable with because they've never been exposed to it. But when you have been, and it's just a part of life, and people are different, and it enriches your world and your life, you know, I think that's probably the most important thing we do. And I mean, I'm always growing and I'm always learning. And as much as you think you know, somebody will say something, you'll be like, oh, wow, I never knew that before, you know, and then it changes your world again. The only constant in this world as a person is change. And so if you keep your eyes open and you can keep bringing these things to the public and to yourself, you're just always going to grow, because it's not static. No matter how much we may want it to be one way and be happy and, you know, everything's perfect, it just isn't. But, you know, there's so much you can learn to just make you a better person and a better human. And hopefully that's what this does, this film festival.
So, Debbie, I want to know, you know, with technology that is taking over all over the world, you know, people now have access on telling their stories. On the festival, were there films, a documentary or short films that were done, you know, with the minimum budget? And also, what does that highlight for the film industry, including the festival? Is it a good? Is it bad? Because I know that filmmakers, there was even a time where in Hollywood, writers, you know, having their protests regarding that, especially now we're living in a time of artificial intelligence. All this technology that is coming out all over the world, it's good and bad for the film industry, but you, as someone who's a veteran, you know, in this industry, what do you think of this technology? Can we as human beings, especially those who are creatives, take advantage into telling their stories, or do you feel like it's also damaging the industry?
Yeah, that is definitely a multi-layered question there. And I was just talking, we had a panel on the film festival about writing and asked a couple of the writers and filmmakers what they thought about it. And, you know, I can agree. My own opinion is that there are some uses for AI. And while it was helpful, I think it's actually gotten very dangerous, because there is going to come a time where we don't know what's real anymore. It's hard enough for people to tell that right now. So there needs to be some sort of disclaimer, and it must be absolutely legally mandated that if you do something that has AI in it, you need a predominant byline or something that says AI generated. AI alter, I think you must have that, because otherwise you just don't know what's real anymore. But as far as films, the thing that AI is good for is basically usually post. And what I mean by that is, one of the filmmakers had said that what he used to spend $20,000 for some post service, I don't know if it was sound or whatever he used, but all of a sudden now he get it for like $19.99. But unfortunately, that means some people are going to be out of work, you know. So there's things like cleaning up sound, although somebody tried that with one of my films and I had to pay somebody to refix it. This was earlier, but everybody sounded mechanical to me and I wasn't happy with it, because we had to clean up some sound because of the exterior noise that interfered. But maybe it's gotten better now. So for that kind of stuff, unfortunately, it's going to hurt some people, but it doesn't. I don't consider it taking over the creative process per se, because it's a technical thing, even though, of course, it's all creative. But if you're actually going to use AI-generated characters, I don't really want any part of that. I have a huge respect for actors. You want actors and you want scripts that have soul and heart. You know, you want people that can pull from within and bring something that the audience can create. You don't want characters who have an impossible ideal that it's not possible to match. They don't like the way that they Photoshop models and whatever magazines. Okay, so they're beautiful enough, which is impossible, but then you make them even impossible by you know, Photoshopping things and changing things. And I think people want to be involved with real people. They want to know who they're seeing on the screen as something written by somebody who has a heart to touch them. Because really, all AI does is they get trained from what you put out there. They throw it in a giant computer or generator or whatever they do, and they spit out stuff. But it's not original. You know, not that there's really any original stories anymore. You just tell them differently. I'm not a fan of it. And I took personal offense to an ad I saw once about, hey, we can tell your story. Give us an outline or give us some information. Or we can write your novel or your script for $200. Nobody's writing that for $200. What they're doing is they're throwing it in a generator and it's just going to spit out information. And then the person gets to call themselves a writer. And I take offense at that. Writers are a very special breed. I think that you have to put the work in, you know, to call yourself one or to call yourself a filmmaker. You know, everybody does what they do. Now, I think there's an exception. If you have somebody who's very handicapped, who can't make a film otherwise without that, I think that then there has to be an understanding. You know, hey, I have a story to tell, and I don't have the money, and I don't have the funds, and I don't have the capability to do the set. That then that's different. But that should be the only case, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there's it's an art. You know, an art shouldn't be computer generated. You know, at least that's my own personal feeling.
Well, I think you would feel that so strongly because when Kusi was telling you earlier about what do you feel yourself as a filmmaker, creator, and you said first and foremost you're a writer, because not only do you write films, you write novels. And like you were saying with the generators, I had heard one time anytime you put something into ChatGPT, you could write the same question every time, it'll come back a different answer. So from your perspective as someone who's been in the business for so long, why do you think writing is so important? And on top of that, how do you separate the creative process when writing a movie versus writing a novel? Because they're both storytelling, because you write novels too.
Yeah, I mean, maybe as a creator, my number one thing really is storytelling, because it doesn't matter the medium. The processes are very different. And the funny thing is, as I said, I started as a novelist. And yeah, I mean, I loved it. I have a couple more novels in progress other than the three that are already published. Once I wrote a screenplay, and the first screenplay that I actually finished that was at all decent is called The Last Taxi Driver. I'd written in the past, but I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, it was just fun little script. But then the second one just became much more heartfelt. I think that's when my heart came into it. My heart goes into my books, too. If I'm sitting here and all of a sudden I'm crying as I'm writing, then I've touched something in me that's going to touch something in someone else. And it's about that connection. And I've come to realize that, I mean, yes, everybody would love mass appeal. You would love the money coming in and whatnot. But I write the stories for the people who need to hear them. So you might have people, you know, they like your film, but then you have people that will come up to me after, because some of my films have a very spiritual base, even though it's not sold as that. For example, my movie, Living, is about a woman that has to leave her family for various reasons, which you discover at the end. People will come up to me after and go, oh, my God, thank you. Thank you. That helps me understand this and helps me understand that. And I had another movie I did years later called The Waiting Room. The story of it is basically a woman who's passed away. She's, you know, up in heaven or purgatory or wherever she is, and she's having a grand old time painting and dancing. And then her husband comes up 10 years later, but he comes up with a second wife. And it's a comedy, but it's also what happens after. And I've had people say to me, one downloaded it. It used to be on Prime. I think I took it off at this time. But he downloaded it because I watch it all the time, because all I think about is, if anything happens to me, what will my wife do? You know, or if anything happens to my wife, what will I do? And who'll be there for me? And to get people to think, you know, and to imagine themselves and to maybe answer something for somebody, that was the person who needed to see that. The people who come up to me after are the people who need to see that, you know. So I don't know why I write. I believe that it makes sense that I channel, you know, that if I'm sitting down on a black page and blank page and I get an idea, once my hands are on the keyboard, I don't even know where it's going until it goes there. So, yeah, some I obviously know I'm consciously writing, but then I'll read it back and go, wow, that's really great. I wrote that, you know, but apparently I did. But your subconscious takes over and you know, becomes what it is. And that doesn't mean it's perfect. You'll go back and you rewrite, you make it make sense, you clean up, you cut down, you edit. It's the process is different. I want to get back to novels. It's hard once you've written screenplays, because screenplays are about showing, not telling. And novels are about telling in a way that makes people see. So you have to be careful to not be too wordy in a screenplay, but you have to be just wordy enough in your novel so that they can see what you're writing. And I had been told I write very cinematically. And I guess because I always had a screenwriter inside of me, even though I hadn't done it yet in the beginning. Yeah, it's very cathartic. I know I make my husband crazy sometimes, because I read out, when I do a screenplay especially, I read all the parts out to myself as I'm doing it, because if it flows, then it works. But if I'm, you know, getting tangled up in the words, then I know I need to clean something and change and whatever. So the process is different, because one is just more verbiage related, and the other is more feeling related, although they both account for both. I mean, I'm told my strength is my dialogue, you know. So that's, I mean, the stories are there. They're not necessarily complicated stories. They're feeling stories. In fact, if you had to pick a genre for me, it'd be messy relationships. I mean, I've done horror, I've done thriller, but really my relationship stories, I think, are the ones that grab people the most.
If you have just tuned in now, you're tuning in to the One World Community Radio Network, which was co-founded by 89.5 FM Bush Radio in Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio in Hofstra University. The show highlights the power and the reach of independent community radio stations around the world. And our motto is, the world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we are bringing it right to your door. The show is hosted by Andy Gladding, Cody Helmer, and also myself, Kusi Vieto, and Ricky Hubert. And also our guest for today, we are joined by the creator, or the film creator, who is Deborah Markovitz, speaking to us. And also they just wrap up a festival on highlighting on that festival. So Debbie, I know that when I touch a little bit on technology, now we're living in a time where the attention span of human beings is so small. You know, with social media now, we have things like reels, like shorts, where small creatives anywhere in the world can be in a village in Africa, you know, where people can tell their story to a point where they get following, they get likes, some they even get donations so that they can continue with their content. I want to know from you as a creative, is storytelling changing now or is it evolving? You know, some are saying that anything that doesn't want to evolve, it dies out, especially on things like languages. I want to know, is filmmaking evolving instead of being just that Hollywood style?
Sure. Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that's why there is the attention given to short films. It used to be, why would you ever make a short film? You can't sell a short film. Well, there's several reasons. I love the short film medium myself because you can get a beginning, middle, and end and make an impact and really touch somebody in the heart in like 10 minutes, sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes 20. It has to be as long as the story needs to be. The difference with features, yes, there is a shorter attention span, but especially if you're home, you can put it on pause, do what you got to do, come back, because we do have short attention spans. That actually concerns me. You know, I think it's important to also, reading is so important. You learn, you know, I tend to listen to audiobooks while I walk and work out and whatnot, but I really need to make time to sit down and read because it engages your mind more. And that's so important. So short films, yes, that is changing. It's no longer just something to do because you can't afford to make a feature. It's a calling card because when my first movie came out, I started getting work because people could see that, oh, wow, that was really good. Can I hire you to do this? Can I hire you to do that? It wasn't my intention. You know, in my case, it worked. So it's a calling card, but it's also a way to make an impact. And if you want to meet other filmmakers and your film gets into a film festival, you can travel there and meet other people, which is really important, is to have that sense of community. Now, with TikTok and with all these other things, even shorter content is, you know, I think it's important. I think it's fun. I think it has a place to make an even quicker impact. I'm just concerned that people don't think as much as they need to, sadly. And I think it's kind of reflective of a lot of the world right now. So it's a balancing act. Yes, people, one of my husband's students, he's had some extremely bright students. One made her living from a TikTok video. She's an influencer or whatever. But how are these things checked for validity? You know, just because you make a really impactful video, is it even true? You know, so boy, there's so many concerns with that. But as far as the short and medium self, absolutely there's a place for it, you know, without question. Short films are going to be my thing because it's just, I come from a film background. Not saying I wouldn't even make these shorter videos if I had the time to figure out what I want to do and how to do it. But yeah, I think there's always going to be a place for movies. People, well, at least until this generation coming up, people had favorite movies, movies they would watch over and over again. I don't know if the generations after this are going to be able to sit through entire movies. I don't honestly know. I hope so. You know, I hope that there's a coming back of, hey, you know, the classics are there for a reason, and maybe I can learn something from them. Something maybe I read or watched when I was younger, I didn't really understand, but then I read it or watched it as I was getting older, and it's like, oh, that's what that meant. You know, so it's just important that besides we go with the new technology, that we don't just toss the old stuff out either. If there's something that's maybe not politically correct, have a disclaimer in the beginning, you know, or have a conversation after. Say, yeah, that was acceptable then. It's not acceptable now. Using it, use everything as a learning moment. I think that's so important.
And something else about you, Debbie, that I found, we were talking about this before you went on the air, because you worked in the Nassau County Film Commissioner's Office for like 33 years, correct?
Correct.
And then you left that life behind to go become a filmmaker of your own and do your own filmmaking. Making a career transition at any stage of life is very difficult for a lot of people, and understandably so. And I'm, even though you're working in film, this could apply to anybody, which is what's so great about this show. What made you decide, okay, this is the moment that I have to do this, and gave you the courage to make that decision and take the leap? Because it's a very brave thing to do.
Yeah, it's not easy. It is brave, but I had also set myself up to be able to do what I do in a way that I only ever needed to take in the jobs I wanted to take and make the movies I wanted to make. And the way I did that was, you can consider it smart, you can consider it cowardly, I don't know. But the way I did that is I started my filmmaking career while I was still working. So while people took vacations and people took off on the weekend and people slept at night, I was writing or making movies. So I would go, you know, go to work 9 to 5. I was lucky enough to have a job to do that. Also lucky enough to have a job where I was there for so long, I had a lot of days off. So, you know, people were going to Italy and I was working on a movie. People were getting 8 hours sleep and I was getting 3 hours sleep and writing. You know, people were taking off on the weekends to relax. That's when I got, you know, I kicked into gear. So I did that for probably at least 12 years. I put in so much time working on the other side of my career, because I knew when I left that I already wanted to have my career in full swing. And I'm not, I don't know, I'm some sort of workhorse. I'm a creative workhorse where I've always been able to work hard and I actually really thrive on it. You know, it's not like I was beating myself into the ground. And if I did get to that point, then I'd say, all right, I got to step back and rest a bit. You know, I seem to know how to do that. But as I said before, I was even working full time, going to college at night, and then working part time on the weekend to pay my bills, you know, so that I could also get my college degree. So that kind of shifted from working full time and working full time again in my off hours to be able to have the career that I have now. I realized that John had said to me, my husband said to me, you realize you turn down a job a day, because even if you give up all your free time, there's only so much free time you have. You know, if I'm going to limit myself to 3 to 4 hours sleep, I can't limit myself to no sleep, you know. So I had to give it a long thought. I was able to, I stayed long enough to get a pension from the county, so I would have that as a backup. I also was able to, I'm a big saver. It's not that I've ever had a lot, but I've always made sure that no matter what, I put something away, you know, so I was able to have some backup cushion there. So by the time I started my career, my full-time filmmaking career, I was already in the process for 12, 14 years, whatever it was. So I didn't start new. I don't think that I would have quit my job and say, hey, I want to be a writer and just start with nothing, because I got bills to pay. I have a house, I have a dog, I have, you know, cars and things that need to be paid. I think while that's a very brave thing to do, I think it's also a little insane, because the bills come no matter what. And unless you have some sort of cushion or somebody who's going to pay your bills for you, I never wanted to be a starving artist. There's a lot of pain and angst and you know, rejection and imposter syndrome and all kinds of things that come from being a full-time artist. But I didn't want to be living in my car and writing. I set myself up to be in a place where, oh, great, I have 2 jobs now, you know, before the end of summer. Terrific, I can do that. Roll that money over to one of my own projects. So it was very strategic. And it took place over a long period of time. Not everybody has that. I think you have to do what you love, but I think you can do that and be responsible for your bills and your health care and everything else. So it depends on how you look at it. To me, this worked out perfectly. I'm not a believer in waiting until you're ready because you can say, all right, I'm going to work 30 years and then I'm going to concentrate on this. But we don't know how long we're going to live. If you want to get existential, you could get ready to your 30th year and then your bus hits you. You don't know. So I was always very adamant to do what I loved while I was still doing what I needed to do to be able to survive and survive well. Now, that's my philosophy. Work and do this because you'll be energized to do what you love, even if you're not getting any sleep. If you love it and you truly love it, you'll make time for it. So that's the way I've done things.
Deborah, I know that we're running out of time. We have like 6 minutes now. Quickly, what are you busy with now? I know that the festival just ended. What project are you busy now in 2025? And what should we look out for? And where can people follow you in terms of being updated of what are you busy with?
Okay, well, my website is intentionfilmsandmedia.com, so they can always check out. I have to update it, but they can check out everything I'm doing. My Instagram is at Deborah Markowitz Film, DeborahMarkowitzFilm. So at Deborah Marks Film, Markowitz Film at Instagram is a way to find out. But I have a feature that was just completed called Waitlist, A Lover's Story, and we're now talking to sales agents. So hopefully that'll be released sometime in the next 2, 3 months. We wrapped on a feature film that was originally called Brimstone. We're changing the name to From the Embers, and that's just going into post-production now. We have short films all over the festival circuit. There's the Brimstone short. We're going to editing with a Brimstone lullaby. Oh, I know there's more. We're going into post on a short called Silent Harmony, a pilot called Welcome to Bellevue. There's so much stuff. So really, the best thing is to follow me on Instagram or also to just keep checking the website. And there's also a contact us section, so people can do that. And that's about it.
And before we wrap up, one last question. Because you had mentioned with the students that you and your husband kind of watch and learn from and try to help out. And you were saying you hope that they learn from the older films and generations before. What is the biggest thing that someone like you, a creative workhorse, has learned from these students and how have you applied that to your craft?
That's really good. I mean, we always get excited when we find a really, really bright young person that we can learn from. I mean, they have a ton of energy. They're new, they're hopeful if they're great on set. And again, we've worked with a few people like that. They bring a young energy. Now we tend to have young energy, even though we're not young anymore. But it just keeps the energy on the set great. It's finding out what they need to know. My husband's a brilliant guy, so he keeps up on everything. He knows all the new technology. I kind of know what I need to know. Otherwise, I look at him and go, all right, so how do we do this? So luckily it's a really, really great partnership. But the fact is we can't afford on most of our projects to pay a lot. Everybody gets paid, but we can't afford to pay a lot. So if you get new people coming in and you can guide them and work with them and train them, and they in turn bring their energy and their enthusiasm and maybe a different perspective, then that's just like a perfect way to go. You help them on their way. And if you need help down the line, a lot of them are willing to, they even have really big careers right now. And they're like, I'm free these 3 days. You need me, I'm there. So it's just basically the combination of all the energy. I hope that answered that.
Yeah, that's it. The energy, the energy, the energy, the energy. Well, we thank you for bringing some of that energy to the One World Community Radio Show. Again, I know Kusi mentioned it, but where can people find you?
IntentionFilmsAndMedia.com, or they can also check out my Instagram at Deborah, DeBRA Markowitz Film. So if they Instagram's probably the best way.
All right. And Deborah, we thank you very much for coming on our show today. You have been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech, and Bush Radio 89.5 FM, the mother of community radio in Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
My colleagues and I at NOW didn't play by the conventional rules of Beltway journalism. Those rules divide the world into Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, and allow journalists to pretend they have done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news.
That's Bill Moyers, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bill Moyers in defense of public broadcasting. The founding principles of public broadcasting urged that programming serve as a forum for debate and controversy and provide a voice for groups that may otherwise be unheard. Ever since its inception, public broadcasting in the United States has been a lightning rod for political attack. A heat shield funding proposal to insulate PBS and NPR from congressional whims was defeated. The Nixon administration was the first to launch the canard that the system was biased in favor of liberals. Note that the longest-running public affairs program on PBS was iconic conservative William F. Buckley's firing line. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, partially funds public TV and radio. In mid-July, Congress, by razor-thin margins, voted to eliminate previously approved funding for CPB. This action will negatively impact hundreds of public TV and radio stations. Staff will be laid off, programs will be discontinued, and some stations may go off the air. To talk about public broadcasting is someone who was there at its beginning, Bill Moyers. Bill Moyers was a celebrated journalist and commentator. He hosted and produced many of PBS's most acclaimed programs. He was the winner of over 30 Emmy Awards. He passed away in late June, but the principles he championed remain vital. Public broadcasting, independent media, and journalism are crucial for a healthy democracy. As he would say, now is the time to act to defend public broadcasting. Support your local station as best you can. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the Conference on Media Reform in St. Louis. And now, Bill Moyers.
The story I've come to share with you goes to the core of our belief. Quality of democracy and the quality of journalism are deeply entwined. I can tell this story because I've been living it. It's been in the news, including more attacks on a single journalist, yours truly, by the right-wing media and their friends at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. CPB was established almost 40 years ago to set broad policy for public broadcasting and to be a firewall between political influence and program content. What some on its board are now doing today, led by its chairman, Kenneth Tomlinson, is too important, too disturbing, and yes, even dangerous, for a gathering like this not to address it. We're seeing unfold a contemporary example of the age-old ambition of power and ideology to punish the journalists who tell the stories that make princes and priests uncomfortable. First, let me assure you that I take in stride attacks by the radical right-wingers who have not given up demonizing me. They've been after me for years now. And I suspect they will be stomping on my grave to make sure I don't come back from the dead. But I should put my detractors on notice They might just compel me out of the rocking chair and back into the anchor chair. Who are they? I mean the people obsessed with control, using the government to threaten and intimidate. I mean the people who are hollowing out middle-class security even as they enlist the sons and daughters of the working class to make sure Ahmad Shalabi winds up controlling Iraq's oil. I mean the people who turned faith-based initiatives into Karl Rove's slush fund, who encourage the pious to look heavenward and pray so as not to see the long arm of privilege and power picking their pockets. I mean the people who squelch free speech in an effort to obliterate dissent and consolidate their orthodoxy into the official view of reality from which any deviation becomes unpatriotic heresy. That's who I mean. And if that's editorializing, so be it. A free press is one where it's okay to state the conclusion you're led to by the evidence. One reason I'm in hot water is because my colleagues and I at Now didn't play by the conventional rules of Beltway journalism. Those rules divide the world into Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, and allow journalists to pretend they have done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news. Jonathan Merman writes about this in a recent essay in World Policy Journal. Merman quotes David Ignatius of the Washington Post on why the deep interests of the American public are so poorly served by Beltway journalism. The rules of the game, says Ignatius, make it hard for us to tee up on an issue without a news peg. He offers a case in point. The debacle of America's occupation of Iraq. If Senator so-and-so hasn't criticized post-war planning for